Sorry. Okay. So this is an anesthetized rodent, and we're stimulating actually the forelimb. And because you get a response on the contralateral side, and you put an electrode in, and this is a very, very large multi-unit response. Okay, this is basically 1940s electrophysiology in an animal, nothing special. If at the same time you look at what happens to individual blood vessels on the surface of the animal, then there's this sort of locus of maximum electrical response. This is where the this red envelope is as large as possible. And you find very, very close to the envelope, you get a rather large increase in the diameter of the vessels, like 15% increase. That's quite a hefty increase in flow. And you also get a little bit of a rebound, inhibitory rebound. Okay, now, there's two ways, of course, to get electrical stimulation into a cortical column. One is this direct path, in this case, going through the spinal cord through contralateral thalamus. And the other way is from the contralateral side through the corpus callosum over to the ipsilateral side. So let's see what's happening on the ipsilateral side. Okay, so if we stimulate and we look at the ipsilateral side, again, we see a net increase in electrical activity. And if we do other measurements that are not shown here, like looking at measures of oxygen utilization with this 2-deoxyglucose technique, or looking at widespread activity with voltage-sensitive dyes, you still see an increase in electrical activity. And you can see there's a little bit more of a delay between the stimulus and the onset of activity, just because there's this extra bit of distance to go through the corpus callosum. So what happens to the blood? Well, I know, and the rat knew. Goes down, right? So, in fact, the vessels, the diameter of the vessels is decreasing, they're constricting. Okay, so the difference here is that instead of input coming predominantly to this middle layer, layer 4, the input is really coming into the upper layers and mid layers, sort of 2, 3, and 5. Okay, so it doesn't really tell you, we haven't identified neurons, we're not recording from identified neurons, but it's just sort of a proof of principle that the whole idea of electrical activity going up and blood flow going up just does not cut it. So there has to be something more fundamental going on. Okay, so throughout the course of the next day, there's been a couple of hypotheses. I'm just going to sketch these. They're not independent. They're almost straw men or straw women, I might say. But one is really that there are vasoactive products of metabolism, you know, protons, ADP, that are released. The other hypothesis, just sort of extreme cases, is that there are things that relate to sort of synaptic products, co-transmission, NO, activation of astrocytes. So the last idea is that really the master regulator is hemoglobin itself. And this is sort of an interesting experiment because it also bears on the issue that this leads to an interesting experiment because it sort of bears on the issue that just an increase in metabolic load itself, okay, or the which if you have enough energy around in terms of oxygen, that's not enough just to cause an increase in blood flow per se. So let me just sort of sketch this experiment. This was done in Dernagel's laboratory. The question was, let's get rid of the hemoglobin. Let's actually put so much oxygen into the animal, right, that the system is, the serum, right, the blood plasma is completely perfused with oxygen. You don't need to pull oxygen off red blood cells, and you're not making any kinds of noticeable, of significant amount of deoxyhemoglobin. So you put an animal basically in a pressure cooker at 3 atmospheres of oxygen, and again, you say, can I look for changes, okay, in the total cerebral blood flow during stimulation, and say now that there's all the oxygen around, somehow do I not actually change the amount of flow in vessels? Okay, so this ignores, of course, needs for sugar and things like that. And again, if you stimulate, you find out you get about the same amplitude response in normal oxygen and in 3 atmospheres of pure oxygen, which if you stay in there too long will almost cause you to convulse. And again, you see during that time, the response of the yellow curve versus the baseline curve, the blue curve, are essentially the same. Okay, so somehow it's just pulling off oxygen itself is not enough. So again, there's sort of this puzzle that's out there. Okay, so how is this sort of addressed? I stole this slide from Edith, and you got this funny impression. So there's two kinds of reviews out there about blood flow. There are reviews that only pay attention to the astrocyte. So they would have a picture that looks like this, and they would cut out the interneurons. And then there's another kind of review that has just the interneurons, no offense, okay, but kind of cuts out the astrocytes. But let me sort of frame in sort of my understanding a little bit what's going on. You have this sort of push-pull system where with neural activation, various inhibitory interneurons get excited. Inhibitory interneurons can co-release vasoactive substances. And some of these substances, okay, like somatostatin, will cause the vessels to constrict, and other materials like VIP will cause the smooth muscle to relax, to dilate. And so you have this competition which comes from the direct activation of inhibitory neurons. So this already sort of poses an interesting question, because if you knew the pattern of activation of different interneurons, which itself is a study and itself is addressable with the right, you know, today the right genetic animal, you can try to capture this interplay. Now on top of this, okay, the inhibitory neurons, which in some sense act directly, you have astrocytes, which are activated through our excitatory cells, which don't act directly, but will activate astrocytes. And then astrocytes themselves can use breakdown products of arachidonic acid to either lead to vasodilation with prostaglandins or vasoconstriction with another breakdown product, 20 heat. So we'll hear about this. But this one picture perhaps to keep in your mind is that you have direct and indirect action from cells in the brain. You also have inputs coming from outside the brain, and some act to cause vasoconstriction, and some act to cause vasodilation. And it's sort of the pattern of neural activity which can tell you who wins. Okay, and that may be sort of the game to understand why seemingly different patterns of cortical activation are leading to either dilation or constriction. So there's a logic, and sort of perhaps a goal of the next, very, very maybe lofty goal the next 3 days is to think a little bit about how we could formalize this, right? We know vascular output, that's fairly straightforward. That's a function of the muscle tension. It's a function of the connectivity of the architecture of the vasculature. And then you really need a sort of almost, you know, Hodgkin-Huxley approach where you have various inputs, various peptides, some of which cause constriction, some of which cause dilation, activation of astrocytes. So, you know, at the end of the day, there should be an equation, a logic that tells us if we knew the neural activation, we should be able to write down what's happened to the vasculature. It's not so crazy, right? If you add it up, there's maybe a dozen state variables. Some might be slaved. Seems easier than a thalamic neuron, which, depending who you talk to, has a good 14 state variables. Okay, so let me just sort of presage people's talks, just sort of introduce everybody with a little bit of sort of their background. Okay, Martin Lorentzen has really worked out sort of very nicely sort of paradoxes how oxygen metabolism and different components of neural activity relate to each other. This is from one of his works on cerebellum, and you can see we're measuring a measure of utilization of oxygen. This is CMRO2. Bicuculine, this is in cerebellum. Bicuculine releases inhibition, utilization goes up. But interesting now, if you cut all the spiking in the system so that none of the Purkinje cells are spiking, actually you get no difference in the baseline. So Martin has really taught us a lot about how the balance of neural activation and synaptic activation modifies oxygen utilization in the brain. The talk after that, just because so much time has gone by after all the introductions, right? I feel I have to repeat this, okay? Okay, Brian McVicker has sort of worked out very nicely understanding the role of oxygen, particularly the role, how it's regulated in astrocytes. And this opens up the possibility of using slice preparations, which we'll get back to, and you could actually look at the diameter of vessels and how the diameter changes with respect to neural activation and changing different measures of oxygen tensions. You can actually see how the vessels move with both pharmacology and oxygen. Okay, so tomorrow, Frank is going to give us background on glia. Aren't these amazing pictures? Okay. So this is one glia cell. This is in two dimensions. I mean, this is like crumpled paper. It's just a sinuous cell that wraps all around vessels. This comes from the famous Brainbow Animals out of Jeff Lichtman and Josh Sane's empire. And you can see that they, you know, this is two dimensions, so they overlap, but they're sort of tiling the space. The different glia sort of tiling the space. Each glia is a different fluorescent protein. The other thing that I think that Frank will talk about a little bit is sort of this ultrastructure. The blue is this sort of crumpled paper like glia, and the different colors, red, gold, or amber, are the postsynaptic endings of a neuron. And this gives rise to what's called the tripartite synapse, which is the presynaptic cell, the postsynaptic cell, and it's wrapped in the glia. Okay, so there's some huge numbers of theories about what glia do. The less you know experimentally, the more theories. But this is where most of this energy is utilized in the synapse, so it bears directly on blood flow. Okay, so the Edith wrote also a landmark paper describing how the co-release of different peptide transmitters, other transmitters from inhibitory neurons, regulate flow. And she's also showed us, again using a slice preparation, how you can understand exogenous signaling. In this case, it's the gaseous transmitter NO, so DEA nonate. Is a generator of NO, and you can show directly how this leads to changes in the diameter of different vessels. And again, this can be followed in a slice preparation, and then there was sort of an interesting trick to pre-constrict the vessel in this work. Okay, finally, on Wednesday morning, Bruno Weber has done some beautiful work using vascular fills and tomography at the synchrotron to go ahead and reconstruct the vasculature. This is a chunk of vasculature from the rat. The pictures aren't really doing justice to this chunk, but you get the connectivity between vessels. And then you can go ahead and in a kind of numerical way now, you could understand what happens when you dilate different parts of the network and try to understand where the major changes in flow are. So the circle part corresponds to dilation in one of these penetrating vessels. And these pictures off to the right sort of show you where the largest flow changes are. You can see this large vessel having a flow change, and you can see shifts in pressure that in response to changing flow in a single penetrating arterial. So you get a sense of where the action is, what the influence is of single vessels. Okay, so the last thing is that this meeting itself has this underlying theme of sort of new technologies coming out of neuroscience and what the impact of these are on developing theories. I just want to give a little bit of some of the ties now. These truly are sort of very exciting times. So one thing now is we talked about being able actually to read the output, and we talked about maybe measuring the diameter of vessels, but the fundamental state variable is really measuring the muscle tension and controlling flow. And one can, it's a little bit of an embarrassment that we don't have a measure of pressure in the vasculature. I think that's the most, that's something we have to think hard about. Maybe there's some trick with you know, proteins folding over and some fret sensor. I don't know. That's, again, something else for a glass of wine. But at least you could measure smooth muscle. This is data that Andy Shee took. And you can get transgenic animals where the smooth muscle, is of course, uses calcium to constrict, actually has a calcium indicator built in. And you could actually look at changes in calcium signaling consistent with constriction of the vessel, but more importantly, you could actually read out you know, at least you could read out perhaps in a qualitative way, or at least a proportional way, what the force generated is. So this is, I think, one thing where modern genetics and indicator techniques have been advantageous. The second thing, and which is common to many people's work, is also the ability to look at measures of blood flow and neuroactivation at the same time. So I'll just, again, sketch the second example here. You can go into a chunk of cortex. You could label all the neurons and all the astrocytes, again, with a calcium indicator. One can scan, I think as Frank has showed very nicely, one could scan with a beam for the two-photon microscope. And you could do things like look at the speed with which red blood cells move. At the same time, you're looking at the activity in astrocytes. At the same time, you're looking at neuroactivity, perhaps in response to external stimulation. So you have a way actually to connect flow, neuroactivity, astrocyte activity all at once. Okay, so I lost my pretty channel rhodopsin picture, but that's okay. All right, so this is the schedule. And the last thing I just wanted to remind everybody is that after Wednesday, since actually on Thursday, both Carl and David will be giving theory talks. And on Friday, Ilya Fiet, who's not here yet, will be talking about coding in grid cells in entorhinal cortex. All right. So, wow, it's a whole morning. Okay. Martin, it's up to you.